This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Earlier this week, we spoke with Andrew Jarecki, the director of the new documentary Capturing the Friedmans. He'd set out to make a movie about David Friedman, a children's birthday party clown in New York City. But Friedman was evasive about his own family history, which led Jarecki to wonder what the family story really was. Here's a clip from early in the filmmaking process of Friedman telling Jarecki about his father.
He died of a surprise heart attack about 5 years ago. And it was very, very sad. He was, selfless and altruistic.
But in the end, he wasn't together with your mom.
He wasn't together with my mom at the end.
And when did they make the decision not to be together? Long before he died?
A couple of years before his death. There's some things I don't want to talk about.
Eventually, Jarecki discovered the family stories David Friedman was reluctant to tell. David's father, Arnold, collected child pornography. When he was arrested for getting some through the mail, it unleashed a much wider investigation. In the end, Arnold and his youngest son, Jesse, were accused of sexually molesting students in the computer classes that Arnold taught at home. Arnold and Jesse maintained their innocence, but fearing they'd be convicted, they pleaded guilty in the hopes of getting lighter sentences. Capturing the Friedmans raises questions about faulty memory, problems within the legal system, and the elusive nature of truth. It also gets to an issue that I often worry about as an interviewer. Someone who comes off as very sensitive or very amusing in an interview may have a much darker side that I remain totally unaware of. I worry that my interview may therefore be somewhat misleading. This is something Susan Orlean faced after she wrote a New Yorker profile of David Friedman back in 1994, which focused on his work as a clown and did not mention his family history. Orlean is known for her best-selling book, The Orchid Thief, which was the basis of the film adaptation. We invited her to talk with us about how she reacted when she learned the story of the Friedman family. Your profile of David Friedman ran in 1994, 7 years after Arnold Friedman was arrested on sexual abuse charges. Did you have any clues about the Friedman family when you wrote the piece?
When I worked on the profile, I had asked David a little bit about his family. I was curious about how his parents felt about his choice of professions being a clown. And he was very evasive. He just sort of shunted the questions off. And I decided that it was just a matter of him not choosing to talk that much about his family. And I really didn't pursue it more. My interest in the profile was very much in the here and now. It was, what's the life of a clown like? It seemed like an extraordinary life. Less about the psychological implications of being a clown or his family life. When I finished the piece, I got a letter. The piece was already done. It was already in print. It didn't happen to be on the newsstand yet. I got a letter from someone saying, did you know that David Friedman's father is a pederast? It was kind of a shocking thing to receive, and it was also too late to do anything about it and too late to add it into the piece. And I thought, well, what if I'd gotten that letter a week earlier? Would I have dealt with that? It was hard. It's hard to know. I mean, certainly when I think all of us in the back of our minds have this mythic notion that children's clowns are a little weird, that maybe all of them have some sort of unnatural interest in children. So I at first thought this is just one of these rumors. This is a myth. Somebody, maybe it's even a rival. I mean, it's a very competitive world. But it haunted me. And when I heard about the film, it really hit me.
I'm sure that your New Yorker profile of David Friedman encouraged a lot of parents to try to book David Friedman for their children's parties because, hey, he's the guy who was written up in the New Yorker. He must be good. Now, a lot of these same parents would probably have had second thoughts, rightly or wrongly, if they had known that David's brother and his father were accused and then pled guilty to sexual abuse charges, even though outside of the courtroom, they maintained their innocence. Do you wonder about the impact of your story on his life and on, you know, what parents are thinking now who hired him as a result of your article?
Definitely thinking about it. It's the nature of making public someone's life is so complex, and it's so fraught with responsibility. And in this case, first of all, I think it's you have to separate the fact of David from his father and his brother. David is a separate person. There was never any implication in anything that he had anything inappropriate to do with these kids. But if I were a parent and I heard that the clown I was going to hire had a family history like that, I probably wouldn't hire him. There's so much that comes with writing about people or exposing people to the public eye. When I was doing a profile years ago of someone who was in a religious position of, you know, of stature in his community, and he grew to feel very comfortable with me, and then one day he told me, he said to me, "Do you want to come meet my mistress?" And I thought, well, I really don't know what to do. A part of me was thinking, well, this is great for my story. I mean, here this guy is standing in his community as somebody who's of some position in a religious, fairly conservative community, and he's introducing me to his mistress. You know, this was overwhelming. I didn't know what to do. Did I want to have his wife read in the New Yorker story about him that he was having an affair? I didn't know if I really felt that I could put myself in that position morally. I mean, no matter what, as a writer, you still have to be a moral person and make decisions. It would have been good for the story. It would have added an element that would have been really interesting. I couldn't do it. If I had heard that David Friedman's father was a pedophile, you know, to return to that, what would I have done?
What would you have done? Do you think you would have written the story?
Yes. I would have written the story, and I would have folded it in with a great deal of delicacy, because I don't think it's fair to imply that it's very much in the American tradition that you don't hold someone responsible for acts committed by members of their family. I don't know. I guess this is the great question in being a writer and your moral obligations to your subjects and the fundamental inability to ever know the truth and your need to kind of acknowledge that in your writing.
Are there any parts of your piece on David Friedman that read differently to you now? Now that you know more about the Friedman family, and here's the part I'm thinking of. You have a part in which you say about Friedman, he also started doing performances at parties for adults under the name David Friedman, as opposed to under the name Silly Billy, his clown name. For adult parties, he does magic, and he's developed expertise in the field of off-color balloons. He has mastered a balloon man with a rising and falling erection, and he believes he will soon have a breakthrough involving ejaculation.
The minute I heard about this movie, that part of the piece flashed through my eyes. It was something that when he showed it to me, I thought it was kind of crude. It's not the sort of humor that I find appealing. Now it's chilling.
Have you spoken to David Friedman recently, like since the release of the movie Capturing the Friedmans?
I've had a lot of email exchanges with him, and I hadn't heard from him in a number of years. I don't keep in touch with people generally after I've written about them. He got in touch with me about several months ago. He really wanted me to see the movie. He really supported the movie, and it mattered to him that I saw it, which is interesting given that we're not friends. We haven't stayed in touch. And he said he wanted to sit and talk with me about it, and we haven't managed to do that yet. But it seems interesting. I don't feel that he lied to me. I asked him a little bit about his family. He dodged not in an unusual way, simply deflected the question. He never lied to me. Had he lied to me, I would be angry, and I would feel that I'd been manipulated. In this case, he simply avoided a painful subject, and it's interesting to me that he wants to talk to me now and maybe explain a little more what was going through his mind when I was working on the profile of him.
But that's the thing. If you've written a portrait of someone and then you find out something about their past that leads you to an understanding of them and their work that you didn't have before, particularly if it's something dark about their family, do you feel betrayed that they didn't volunteer this information? Or do you feel like, well, who would volunteer that information? And they have a right to their life and to their work without this really disturbing part of their family life, this really upsetting part of their family life, kind of penetrating every action that they make?
It's a two-edged situation. I guess to begin with, I present myself as a writer as fallible, as subjective, not as an omniscient observer of the people I'm writing about. And part of that is because I've come to believe and understand that it is impossible to know someone thoroughly. And we don't even know ourselves thoroughly. How could we possibly know someone that we spend a limited amount of time with? It's absurd. And I think some of the artificiality and inauthenticity of modern celebrity journalism is all about that, in my opinion. It's spending an hour in a press situation and then writing a piece with the authority and the voice of someone pretending to know somebody well. It's not possible. It's absurd. I hope that my perceptions and my sensitivity to someone's character will lead me to an ultimate truth about them, even if it's not a specific truth. David Friedman struck me as somebody who had a kind of deep, sort of tragic kind of quality, and maybe that's just the nature of clowns. So did I get the specifics right? No, but I don't think I got the truth about him wrong, the fundamental reality of his nature. Do I blame him for not telling me this? Absolutely not. I mean, people, as it is, I consider it kind of a remarkable that anyone is ever willing to talk to a writer. So to begin with, it's something that it's a privilege if someone lets you into their life. I don't want to be lied to, but people lie all the time. Do I feel someone needs to volunteer something this tragic? No, it's not realistic to think that they would.
My guest is Susan Orlean. She's best known as the author of The Orchid Thief. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Susan Orlean. We've been talking about her 1994 New Yorker profile of David Friedman, which she wrote before learning about his family story, the story now told in the documentary Capturing the Friedmans. Orlean is the author of the nonfiction bestseller The Orchid Thief, the story of John LaRoche, his obsession with rare orchids, and his shadowy past. The book is the basis of the film adaptation, which featured Meryl Streep in the role of Susan Orlean. You spent about 2 weeks writing your profile of David Friedman and about 2 years writing about John LaRoche, the subject of your book, The Orchid Thief. You found out all kinds of things about John LaRoche, about his life, his divorce, his car accident, I mean, just, and his crimes. Was it difficult for you to figure out what to reveal, what to keep secret, and what was even true?
It was very hard to figure out what was true. John, in a way, was the ultimate modern subject. He was an unreliable narrator. In fact, that was part of what the book became about to me, was about the myths that he developed about himself. And there was a point in the book when I simply said there were so many things he said to me that seemed impossible. But what mattered wasn't that they, to find out whether or not they were true, but that he was a person who had a need to create a sort of fantasy ego, alter ego for himself. There was a point where he said to me that he had found the oldest fossil pearl that's ever been found. And I thought, well, that just seems hard to believe. But what was important was this was John's character, a need to make himself more important than he was.
Your book, The Orchid Thief, was a bestseller, and that was made into the movie adaptation, which was a very popular film. What impact do you think all of this has had on John LaRoche's life? Are you still in touch with him?
I hadn't been in touch with him for a while, and then I saw him when the movie was first being screened, and he came up to see the film for the first time. I think it was a very unnerving experience for him, even though he was such an egomaniac and loved attention. Seeing himself portrayed in a movie was sort of one step beyond what I think he was prepared for, and he was a little shocked. And then John being John, he started to really enjoy it. He's turned his life around a lot. He's got a very nice woman he's involved with. They have a baby. He's leading the life of almost a yuppie, which is hard to believe given who he was.
Do you think that you proceed any differently now when you're profiling somebody? Now that you've had the experience of The Orchid Thief becoming a bestseller and a film, and now that you've had the experience of profiling the children's clown David Friedman and then finding out after the fact about his family and how his father and brother were both accused of sexually abusing children.
No matter what, I think when I'm profiling someone, I simply have to remind myself constantly of the really enormous moral challenge that it is. The unending fallibility of the process of reporting it's always present in my mind. And I think actually it's very useful to remain humble and be aware of how little you can count on knowing everything and what that means. And it means to emphasize, as I feel like I need to do, that this is a subjective portrait. It's a portrait. It's not a hologram. It's a sketch of someone, and it's someone processed through my perception of them. And I think that I can strive to having it be true, and I know that there will always be things that I'm going to miss. It's just impossible for that not to be the case. So it's a balance. It's a balance between hoping that the facts are right and acknowledging the limits to what, as a writer, I can know about my subjects.
Now, we've talked a little bit about how your writing has affected the lives of your subjects. Because of the movie adaptation in which you were depicted as a character, your life, I'm sure, was changed a lot by the movie. How has your life been changed, and what has that taught you about the effect of being the subject of a movie or a profile?
It's changed my life quite a bit, which I guess I was sort of prepared for, though I didn't know what it would feel like. It's made me more self-conscious in certain ways. I mean, I've enjoyed it. It's been fascinating. It's a bizarre kind of adventure ride. It has made me self-conscious. I feel more observed. And then, it really, in a way, to circle back to what we've been talking about, there's a great deal in the movie that's clearly not true. It's the fantasy of the screenwriter struggling with how to end his movie. So suddenly there's this image of me being presented to the world that goes off in this wild direction of me becoming a drug addict and having sex with my subject and trying to kill the screenwriter. And there are certain people who think this is true. And people who've seen the movie who didn't quite get the turn in the
script. Exactly.
who look at me and say, are you still involved with LaRoche? And I think, oh my God, what have I done? It makes you appreciate the very, very quicksilver nature of truth and reality. And it makes me, well, I'm glad if it makes people a little bit afraid of me.
Why?
Well, it's, you know, instead of being just a normal writer, I'm a writer who pulled a gun on a screenwriter. It's kind of an impressive thing. But it does make you step back a little and think, well, what is reality? I mean, this was Charlie Kaufman's effort to make an honest adaptation of my book. And in order to do that, he had to completely change the facts. So it kind of addresses this issue again, which is truth is very mutable, and no one really can claim to have an absolute hold on it. In this case, my character completely transformed. It's not me at all, and yet that's me as being perceived by people who go to see the movie. So it's been kind of philosophically interesting, and it's made me appreciate my role as the intermediary between the experiences I have and the readers who read my work.
Susan Orlean, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Susan Orlean is the author of The Orchid Thief and writes profiles for The New Yorker. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. British writer Mark Haddon is the author of the new novel, The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. It's told from the point of view of a 15-year-old boy named Christopher, who is a high-functioning autistic. Critic Michiko Kakutani writes, Mr. Haddon writes with such sympathy, such understanding of Christopher's interior life, that he makes all his obsessions and needs into a mirror of our own cravings for safety and order. This is Mark Haddon's first novel. He's written and illustrated several children's books. When his novel begins, Christopher finds his neighbor's dog lying dead, speared by a pitchfork. Christopher wants to find out who did it. The greater mysteries he is faced with have to do with comprehending his parents and the confusing, threatening world around him. Here's a reading from early in the story.
I pulled the fork out of the dog and lifted him into my arms and hugged him. He was leaking blood from the fork holes. I like dogs. You always know what a dog is thinking. It has four moods: happy, sad, cross, and concentrating. Also, dogs are faithful and they do not tell lies because they cannot talk. I had been hugging the dog for 4 minutes when I heard screaming. I looked up and saw Mrs. Shears running towards me from the patio. She was wearing pajamas and a house coat. Her toenails were painted bright pink and she had no shoes on. She was shouting, "What in God's name have you done to my dog?" I do not like people shouting at me. It makes me scared that they are going to hit me or touch me, and I do not know what is going to happen. "Let go of the dog," she shouted. "Let go of the damn dog, for Christ's sake." I put the dog down on the lawn and moved back 2 meters. She bent down. I thought she was going to pick the dog up herself, but she didn't. Perhaps she noticed how much blood there was and didn't want to get dirty. Instead, she started screaming again. I put my hands over my ears and closed my eyes and rolled forward till I was hunched up with my forehead pressed onto the grass. The grass was wet and cold. It was nice.
That's Mark Haddon reading from his new book, The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. Mark, what is your main character's behavioral or cognitive problem?
If he were diagnosed, he would be diagnosed as having Asperger's syndrome, which is a form of autism. I suppose you call it high-function autism, in that he can function on, you know, a day-to-day basis in a kind of rudimentary way. But he has a serious difficulty with life in that he really doesn't empathize with other human beings. He can't read their faces. He can't put himself in their shoes. And he can't understand anything more than the literal meaning of whatever said to him. Although I'm very careful in the book not to actually use the word Asperger's or autism.
Why not?
Because I don't want him to be labelled. And because I, as with most people who have a disability, I don't think it's necessarily the most important thing about him. He's obsessed with mathematics. That's one of the little hobbies he has. It's one of the ways he manages to pattern and organize his daily life and keep chaos at bay. And as a good friend of mine said after reading the book, a friend who is himself a mathematician, it's not a novel about a boy who has Asperger's syndrome. It's a novel about a young mathematician who has some strange behavioral problems. And I think that's right.
Because he sees the world in a very literal way and hears conversation in a very literal way, he doesn't understand jokes, he doesn't get irony, he doesn't understand human emotions, he has no real empathy for other people. What are the things that really scare him because they're so incomprehensible?
Because he can't put himself in other people's shoes, he doesn't really understand what other people are going to do. And other people are therefore extremely unpredictable. He likes his life to be safe and ordered. He's never gone farther than the end of his own road without someone to keep him company. So his life is very small and circumscribed. And it's things that threaten to wreck that pattern. It's change and difference and chaos which really terrify him.
He hates being touched. He can become violent
when indeed,
he's touched.
He does indeed, yeah.
Is that pretty typical of somebody with autism or with Asperger's syndrome?
I think it's fairly common, although a lot of people said to me, he seemed like a very real character. Did you do a lot of research? And I have to say, honestly, that I did more research about the London Underground and the inside of Swindon Railway Station, where some of the novel takes place, than I did about Asperger's syndrome. I gave him kind of 9 or 10 rules that he would live his life by. And then I didn't read any more about Asperger's, because I think there is no typical person who has Asperger's syndrome. And there is large and diverse a group of people as any other group in society. And the important thing is that I did a lot of imagining, that I did a lot of putting myself into his shoes and trying to make him come alive as a human being, rather than getting him right, whatever that might mean.
Now, that's an interesting exercise for you, because what you're doing is putting yourself through the exercise of having empathy for a boy because of his problems, can't empathize with other people.
That's true, and I realized very shortly after I started writing the book that the whole thing was littered with, you know, paradoxes. On the surface, it's a very, very simple book, partly because his voice is a very, very, very simple voice. And yet you're right, it needs a lot of empathy to write a character who has no empathy. Another paradox is that he says he can't tell lies. He needs to tell the truth all the time, and he always tries to do this. And yet, somehow, he always gets things wrong. We read the novel over his shoulder, saying, "You've got this wrong, you've got that wrong," and we can see more than him. He's a very unreliable narrator. And perhaps for me, the biggest paradox of all is that you'd think someone like Christopher, who can't empathise, who can't understand anything more than literal meaning, who can't see the bigger picture, would be a really bad narrator for a novel. And yet, it's a wonderful, wonderful voice to write a novel in, because it helps you avoid the pitfalls that so many novels fall into. He never explains anything. He never tries to make up the reader's mind one way or the other about anything, because he has no real idea of there being a reader out there.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Mark Haddon. His new novel is called The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. Now, your main character, who is autistic, doesn't read novels. Although he's the narrator in your novel, he has a great deal of difficulty comprehending fiction. And there's a short excerpt I'd like you to read about that.
Mostly I read books about science and maths. I do not like proper novels. In proper novels, people say things like, "I am veined with iron, with silver, and with streaks of common mud. I cannot contract into the firm fist which those clench who do not depend on stimulus." I found this in a book in the library in town when Mother took me into town once. What does this mean? I do not know.
Where does this quote come from? Is this something that you made up to sound as obtuse as he finds metaphors as being?
Funnily enough, it's actually a quote from Virginia Woolf. It was Virginia Woolf on an off day in the middle, I think, of The Waves, an author whom I love, actually, but who sometimes got a little too carried away.
Wow, that's really terrible. That's totally incomprehensible and terrible. But that's your idea of how all fiction reads to him.
Yes, certainly.
One of the things you had to imagine is what it would be like for Christopher to, for the first time, get on a subway by himself and go to London, where he's never been, to find his mother. So he's coming from like a suburb of London to London. Mm-hmm. And it's like the Odyssey for him. So maybe you could just describe how you imagine, for instance, the subway, you know, the train looking from his point of view.
As we all know, when we visit a strange city, particularly in a foreign country, you're bombarded with information and noise and sights and sounds in these places. And for someone like Christopher, who sees everything around him and attempts to understand it all, it's completely overwhelming. Although I have to say that strange as Christopher is, this experience isn't so alien. I think one of the reasons when we read about it that we understand it is because it's an extreme version of something we've all experienced at some time or other in our lives.
What did you most empathize with about Christopher and his confusion?
Of all the parts of Christopher that I empathize with, I have to say it's not the confusion that I empathize with most, it's the mathematics. I don't know whether we've said yet, but the book is peppered with little maths questions and maths puzzles and diagrams. Because he is very good at maths and obsessed with maths, and he uses it as a way of blocking out the world sometimes, in the way that many of us use crosswords or other kinds of puzzles. And that's pretty much like myself. I very nearly did mathematics at university, and even now, after I've had a month or two of novel writing, I get a yearning for numbers again and go back to working on maths for a week or so. So all the maths in the book came straight out of my head, and that is the part of Christopher that is unadulteratedly me.
That's funny, because I thought you were going to say that you often felt so confused by the world and by people's emotions and their response to you in the same way, or in a different way, than he does. But that's not it, huh?
No, I really love interacting with other people, and in that sense I'm very, very different from Christopher. But this is one of the ironies about Christopher. If we talk about Christopher as a whole, everyone talks about Asperger's syndrome and autism and talks about him as a kid with a disability. And yet every single little oddity of his behaviour I have taken from someone that I know who doesn't have that label, who is not called a disabled person, who's not labelled with Asperger's or autism. You know, he has a little habit for determining whether a day is going to be an unlucky day or a lucky day. You know, I know someone who does that. He has a habit of disliking foods that are yellow or brown. I know someone else who's like that. And someone else who can't eat foods if different food types are actually touching on their plate. And all of these people are, you know, quote, normal, unquotes people. But it's only when we put these things together that I find that I've got a portrait of a person that we call disabled.
Do you know somebody who can't comprehend jokes? Because they take everything literally, yeah.
I know a few of those people, and I certainly know a few people. And I, to be honest, most of these people tend to be either scientific or academic people. People who can't really do conversation with others. People who find it very hard to listen to what the other person is saying to them because they're so worried about what they're going to say next that they're concentrating on that.
My guest is Mark Haddon, author of the new novel, The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.